Accession number 27183, Reel 6.
Major Neave, Reel 6. I was asking you when it was that the CO and 2IC managed to get back to regimental headquarters.
What happened was that the Colonel Dick Harrop, who, as I think I told you before, had taken over at fairly short notice, very recently before the assault, he had decided that he wanted to see the tanks of A Squadron launch and set off the swim to the shore, and that he had arranged that a launch would then take him from the A Squadron leader's LCT and find us, the RHQ, by this time very close into the shore, and join us on board before we waded ashore. I was always very skeptical about the validity of this scheme and felt that it would be extremely difficult for him to find us and get back on board. And but he was determined to do it. I could never quite see what he was hoping to achieve by seeing this particular operation. And I always felt a disagreement with him that he should have been on the wireless hearing it, how it was going on from headquarters. But however, he wanted to do it his way, and of course he never did find us back again. And in fact, he never joined us until we were off the beach, some way off the beach. In the meantime, Sim Feversham, who was second in command, on a different LCT to the one that I was on, I think the LCT broke down, or one of the tanks coming wading off it got stuck. In some way he got stuck on the LCT, and it took quite a bit of time before he could get his tank off the craft and onto the shore. And we didn't meet up with him until, in fact, we were off the beach. Or I didn't make contact with him. He may have actually joined up without my knowing he was there, but I don't remember seeing him until we were off the beach.
Were there any important decisions that had to be made
time? You see, I mean, the thing didn't matter from a tactical or operational point of view, because all one could do was to collect information. I mean, the plans were made, everybody knew what they had to do. And to this extent, I mean, if Dick Harrop had wanted to go and watch something, there's no reason why he shouldn't in that sense, because there was nothing he could do really to influence the battle once the thing was committed. He steps the way I saw it. And all I could do was to be there as a central point to receive information and pass information on how the other people were getting on. So there was no operational function. The fact that I was, as it were, in charge didn't have any influence on the thing.
What was keeping you most busy? Was it the rear link or forward links when in this rather chaotic first phase?
Well, it was pretty Tower of Babel situation. Everyone was screaming for information, and it was going backwards and forwards, and everyone was trying to find out what was happening. But in fact, of course, people who were getting on with it on the ground, like my brother Bobby, were the ones who were doing the useful job. And they got the thing, exits clear, and we got off the beach. I mean, that was the long and the short of it. And what the chaos was like behind, as more and more stuff came piling in, I wasn't there to see.
Presumably you weren't looking over your shoulder, you were looking forward
and trying to see what was happening.
You said that during that first stage, the first contact with the enemy, you had certain feelings. You were afraid of being afraid, and that you were very thoroughly alarmed at times. Did you find that once you were actually engaged, you were too busy to be frightened?
Well, I think that's what did happen. I always remember being told that one's... The way it was described to me was that one's fear of being afraid would dissipate because your horizons would suddenly contract to the next 10 seconds rather than the next 50 years, you see what I mean? And that did tend to reduce what might have been panic into, nervous alarm, if you call it that.
I mean, you said that at times you were thoroughly alarmed. Can you remember what sort of things did alarm you while you were going ashore?
Oh, I think a shell landing pretty close was pretty alarming. Mm. And you wondered where the next one was coming from, and did what you could to take cover. But I think one has a limited supply of courage. I think it's an expendable commodity, and you can be very brave for quite a long time and then suddenly find, well, it just isn't there anymore.
Did you have any cases of people breaking down under that sort of strain on D-Day or shortly after?
I didn't see any on D-Day. Later on in the campaign there were one or two cases, which I think were very much, very sympathetically dealt with, really. I think it was understood that this was something that could happen. And when you see in today's contexts the way that people require counselors for almost every situation you can think of, what on earth they would have done in the sort of battle circumstances requiring counselling in those conditions doesn't enter anybody's head. And now if the police get involved in a bit of unpleasantness, they all seem to have 48 hours leave of counselling or something to get over it.
There are some critics of counselling who say that it encourages people to be more badly affected than they would be if they were left alone.
I'm sure that's right.
That it's simply indulgence.
I'm sure that's right. I'm sure that kind of crisis is only solvable by yourself. And unless you've got the necessary... I don't know what the word is to overcome it. From your own resources, it has to come, I think.
There is an old Spanish proverb which says that such and such a man was brave on such and such a day, which indicates a view that courage really can go up and down.
I think that's
with circumstances.
So true. I would
absolutely
subscribe to that. Mm. It's expendable. The way I put it.
It's not a constant thing, then.
Not a constant thing. And I don't know what your experience on this would be.
I haven't really had any direct experience, but I've heard a lot of people saying the same sort of thing as you're saying. Mainly from Second World War.
Yes. Some things made one angry, and that drove out fear.
What sort of things make you angry, sufficiently angry to drive out?
Well, it was saw fear. Some frightful casualties, people being blown to bits, and that sort of thing.
Did you find that there was an attitude of personal hatred and hostility towards the enemy? Did you have that? Did other people you know?
No. I can't say I did. I mean, one made oneself produced a sort of not hate, but of course, I suppose it's rather like you don't hate pheasants when you go shooting. To realize that's the objective is to shoot them and kill them.
But you can't casserole a German.
You can't casserole a German. That's very true. But I mean, I didn't feel one way or the other of dealing with those situations. But of course, it didn't happen every day. I mean, you weren't in contact with the enemy. Certainly not at RHQ, you weren't in contact with them every day.
Another thing that some veterans have said is that they stopped feeling frightened when they got really tired, that fatigue was a cure for fear, that you were simply too tired to be frightened. It was just another expenditure of energy that you couldn't afford.
I think that is true. I think that is true. I think the other thing, I remember once when we were in Germany itself, on a crossroads, where there was a big gun that the Germans had some 15 miles away, and we were in cellars in this small town, and every 6 or 7 minutes a shell would land, and the monotony of this express train arriving and not knowing exactly where it was going to come, I found that a bit unnerving. I didn't like that very much.
The uncertainty, presumably.
Well, you knew the certainty mind. That it was coming, and the uncertainty of where it was next going to actually hit so far, so good. And but I think, I mean, as an example of the expendability of courage, this went on for a whole day. By the end of the day, one was really pretty fed up with them.
You mentioned your batman, Mason.
Yes.
What sort of chap was he and what were his duties?
Mason was a splendid chap. One of my great regrets was that at the end of the war he disappeared completely. He sent me one Christmas card or one card when he had a child. Which he was immensely proud. And I think he was more or less completely illiterate, I think. He had the nicest possible nature. He was a very nice man indeed. He came from Wigan. And he was a chap, his duties were to look after one's kit, really, and keep people looking respectable and tidy. And as smart as was possible in the circumstances. But of course, he wasn't on the scene in F echelon. As I think I've explained, the organization was in three echelons. The F echelon, what you needed to actually conduct the battle. A echelon, which carried the essential supplies of ammunition, food, petrol, and stuff that you needed to continue, and B echelon, which had all the backup. Mm-hmm. And of course, one servant of the mason would be in B echelon, and one might not see him for several weeks at a time. And when he did appear, he would get to a bath and clean clothes and, generally speaking, make somewhere for him to go to bed. And and it, probably it wouldn't have to cook, but if there wasn't anything else, he'd do some cooking.
What was his background? Was he a pre-war regular or
no, he wasn't.
Conscript
he was
or
a, I think he was a conscript, in fact, this chap. And as I say, he appeared to be almost completely uneducated. I don't know whether he was or not, but I never had a chance to tax him on it. And, but he was a very charming, very shy, very unassuming, but I was very fond of him. He was a very nice chap.
Did he stay with you all the way through to the
all
end?
All the way, yes.
Something you mentioned in your diaries is something about difficulty towing porpoises. What were porpoises?
That's why my memory lets me down now. I remember the term, and I remember talking about porpoises. Mm. Towing them on the ground, was it?
I think so, yes. I don't know, but I was just intrigued by the term porpoises, because it's one I haven't
encountered. I wonder what they were.
Encountered.
I do remember them. I do remember the porpoises cropping up. I don't really have to ask somebody that. I just sort that one out. Incidentally, I had a Christmas card this week from Delaval Cotter, now aged 87, I would think, commanding C Squadron, who is now on his own but has moved into a home, and said in his card that he was well but bored, not being in his being in a
sheltered
home. Yes. But it was very nice to hear from him. I'd missed him at the cavalry memorial service in May, and I don't think either of us went to the regimental dinner.
Are there any of the other squadron commanders who were around?
Nobody left alive. Derek Wormald is dead. General Anthony Rugg Price, B Squadron, dead. John Cordy Simpson is dead. Very, very few left.
Presumably some of the troop commanders would still be
a few,
extant,
but
a few.
Not many.
What happened overnight on the night of the 6th of June, after you'd arrived, you'd got across the beach into the across
yes.
the road immediately behind the beach?
Well, tanks can't fight at night, and the squadrons all, when they had achieved as much of their objectives as they could, which were these pillboxes in the most cases, pulled into lager, as we used to call it, all individually and separately, and RHQ pulled into its own lager in a wheat field, I remember. And that's when we got our first prisoners. They started to come in. Two in particular were heard wandering about calling for Hans and Rudy. I can hear them now. They were lost, and anyway, the RSM or somebody went out and said, come on, come in. And there were our two first prisoners, I remember that. Otherwise, we took it in turns to sort of get a bit of sleep, because it had been a pretty long day. I mean,
how much sleep were you able to get that first night?
I don't remember, but I doubt if it was more than an hour or two. I mean, because the wireless was going all the time. And then
what sort of things were coming over the wireless? Because one imagines that, you know, everyone would be trying to get bedded down for the night.
Yes, well, I don't think that's quite what was happening. I think the show was going on all the time, but there were people who were signing off and getting a bit of sleep.
Mm.
But I think it was a lot of administrative stuff, with how many tanks we'd lost and what did we need and what casualties were. Mm. And the generals wanted to know a lot of information, which a good many of us thought was pretty, you know, things that waited a bit. We were busy doing other things, or eating or sleeping or catching up with domestic affairs one way or another.
But were you reporting back through 27 Brigade headquarters?
Yes, yes. Through 27,000 Brigade.
Yes. Were they busy all night, that headquarters?
I imagine they were, very much so. But I'm not sure where they were, actually.
When you were lagered overnight, were you looking after your own security, or did you have any infantry to help?
No, we're probably on the first night. I don't remember. I think we were just about on our own. Mm. We knew we had them. They were all in front of us. They were
yes.
there. Yeah. I mean, I think security was pretty obvious. It was going to be there. They were not likely to be infiltrated by... Although I suppose it could have been, I mean, some enterprising German commando sort of chaps.
There were stragglers about, weren't there, like Hans and Rudy, who might have done some harm had they
But
not
I think
been.
They were pretty demoralised by then. I don't think they were in for a fight.
Did you have anything to do with them, or were they sent straight back to the beach?
No, we did ask them where they'd come from and what they were doing and one thing and another, and the IO of course did all that, and he was a very bright boy, Peter Jarry, and but we didn't get anything very much value. I think they were garrison troops that had been either bombed or shoved out of these bunkers.
And Coastal Defence Division then. During that first day, the German 21st Panzer Division had made a counterattack on 3rd Division as it was advancing inland. Do you remember hearing anything about that during
Very
the course
much so,
of the day?
Yes. But it didn't ever come to anything very significant. That it seemed to have either lost its way, and it was on the left flank that was taking place. And I don't think it was ever a very seriously pursued, and so that's my impression.
You don't remember ever being
petered out, is
it? Yes.
But then, of course, the subsequent days, they did have a much more serious counterattack down in a village called St. Honorine la Chardonnerette, which I always thought was a lovely name, where Derek Wormald's an A squadron, and this was a classic example of how to handle the situation. He was a very brilliant squadron commander. And he had his squadron all in prepared hull down positions, and destroyed a whole mass of, about 6 or 7 German tanks without losing anything himself. Because, I mean, they were in the position on that occasion that later on we were in Goodwood, advancing across relatively open country with into prepared positions with heavy armament, and that was the counterattack by 21st Panzer, which I remember.
But on 6th of June, you weren't ever deployed or warned you might have to deploy to meet an armoured counterattack.
No, I don't remember that at all. One of the jobs on D-Day, which I think was a fascinating story, was that second troop B squadron under Douglas Coker, who later commanded the regiment, actually, was, well, his job was to go to Pegasus Bridge and report to the 6th Airborne Division and produce the tank support for them. And there's a lovely story when he arrived on Pegasus Bridge and saw the general, who was, what was his name? Big fat man.
General Gale.
Gale.
Windy Gale.
Windy Gale. Mm. And he looked exactly like Fred Emney, the actor. But he was a hell of a good chap, this Gale. And he saluted and he said, Lieutenant Coker, commanding 2nd Troop of B Squadron, 13th, 18th Royal Hussars, reporting, sir. Sorry I'm quarter of an hour late. I may have told you that story before. I think it's a wonderful story. It's typical of Douglas Coker, who was a Rhodesian, a very charming chap who died sadly a couple of years ago.
Does history relate General Gale's reply?
He was a jovial chap, and I think he laughed.
You were saying in the diary that on the next day after D-Day, you got involved in some fighting in the area around Hermanville. Do you remember much about that?
I don't remember too much about it. I remember it was all skirmishing sort of stuff.
Yes.
I think it was infantry stuff. I don't remember any tanks firing off very much, except with perhaps machine guns and things.
So you mentioned clearing defensive positions to the west of Hermanville, which would get, you know, getting towards the Canadian sector, wouldn't
yes.
it? Did I mean
we went over the bridge, you see, very soon. I think on D plus one.
Yes,
and we settled down into an orchard there. Where we stayed for several days.
By the bridge, you mean Pegasus Bridge?
Pegasus Bridge.
Yes. So you went over Pegasus.
Went over Pegasus Airborne. Bridge, and right behind it was a little orchard.
Yes.
And we established a very well set up headquarters there. And we were there for quite a few days.
Was that a defensive position, or were you in reserve there?
It was... Well, I mean, we were prepared to defend it,
yes.
but it was really a command post. Mm.
So that was RHQ. What about the squadrons? Were they
squadrons
deployed?
Were all deployed.
Yes.
Some with the airborne, and some, I think, was still one squadron was on the other side of the river.
On the west side.
A squadron, which down at this place,
Saint-Honorine,
La Chardonnerette.
Yes.
And it was there that Ted Derrick did this great defensive success.
In effect, this sounds as though it was an ambush that he managed to...
I think it was prepared attack by the 21st.
Prepared attack by the Germans.
They were trying to drive us back into the sea. And I think it was a very significant battle, which probably has never really been given full credit, because I think it saw them off. And because they were well prepared in these defensive positions...
Do you know who Derek Wormwood was supporting at that time? Was it still airborne forces holding Saint Honorine?
No, I think it was one of the 3rd Division, I think. I don't really remember. My diary might say, but I don't.
Did the Germans precede the armoured advance with a heavy artillery bombardment, or did they just come on?
Well, I think they came on. I mean, I don't think it was a prepared attack in that sense. I think it was a sort of not all that premeditated. I mean, I think they were there and they just came in to see what they could do to budge us.
So it was an armoured advanced contact. Possibly they weren't quite sure where our front line was.
Yes.